Welcome back to the Radio Academy podcast. I'm your host, Georgie Jameson, and this week our guest is Scout Zofia Bolton. Scout was a double gold ARIA winner at this year's awards, winning Best New Presenter for her Prison Radio Association rock show and Best Creative or Technical Innovation Award for the PRA show for BBC Radio 4, The Ballad of Scout and the Alcohol Tag. Scout has had a long history of psychosis combined with alcohol and substance abuse and was released from prison wearing a sobriety tag, which is used to help people control alcoholism. In The Ballad of Scout and the Alcohol Tag, she talks about her relationship with that tag.
My watch knows when I'm sleeping. My phone knows who I'm sleeping with. My ankle monitor and I have a similar bond. It vibrates every 30 minutes to remind me that I'm not allowed to drink. My monitor and I share an emotional circuitry. My secure remote alcohol monitor, or SCRAM as it's known, it lives on me, as close to the bone as it gets. SCRAM reminds me that my biometrics don't belong to me. My behaviour is modifiable. I am monitored.
We'll hear more about that documentary later, but first I wanted to know how Scout felt about that double gold win at the ARIAs.
Oh, what a night. I wasn't expecting either. This isn't false humility. I was not expecting a single thing. For me, it was all about the red carpet experience. That was what I was looking forward to the most, because I thought, I'm obviously not going to win, but it'll be a night of a lifetime. Get all dressed up. So then the first one, that was insane. And then the second one, I'm still having a hard time believing it, but as I'm talking to you now, I'm looking at them both. They're on my dresser over there.
I mean, the second one, you got up and I'm not sure you even said anything. They tried to get you to speak and you said, no, I've said enough. I think that was what you said. And you looked in absolute shock.
I was completely shocked. And at that point as well, because that was for technical creative innovation, I wanted to hand that over to the production team. I thought that made more sense to me that they spoke. So I was happy. But at that point, I was completely, this can't be happening. And when I said, I've said enough, I just thought, I talk for a living. That's my job. I've said enough.
You said you've got them. You can see them there in front of you. What do they mean to you?
They're such a symbol of just everything good that has come out of everything bad that I had to endure. Because before I got arrested, I had about 2.5 years of treatment-resistant rapid cycling, what we thought then was bipolar disorder. And then my diagnosis was changed and all that. And then I was misdiagnosed. But I was just so relentlessly ill that when friends didn't hear from me for a couple of days, they just assumed that I'd died. And it was just getting really, really, really bad. And I didn't think I was ever going to get better. I just thought, this is the episode that is never going to end. So those ARIAs there are a symbol that it did all turn around and I did get better and it can be done. The impossible can be achieved, you know.
We'll talk a bit more about your story in a bit, particularly when we talk about The Ballad of Scout and the Alcohol Tag, which I listened to the other day, the one that won the gold for creative and or technical innovation.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the first award, Best New Presenter, for your Prison Radio Association show, which is a rock show. Tell me about your relationship with music and particularly that genre of music. Has music always been important to you?
Music is essential for me, and it always has been. That was the thing I missed the most when I went to jail, was music. And I did listen to the rock show, I did listen to NPR. My favourite artist is Elliot Smith, and I have every day what I jokingly call my Elliot hour, which is where I need to sit down and turn off the computer and not talk to anybody. And it's just me and Elliot. Just that's it. So it's been essential to me. I grew up on rock music as well. You know, my stepdad, when I was 11 years old, gave me all his old punk vinyls. And then I got really into the subculture and then was a goth and then going out to all the local live gigs. So like seeing my friend's band last night was amazing because it just took me right back there being 14 and chasing all the local bands that you liked around to all the different venues. Getting a minibus so you can all go to the next town on to watch them.
Tell me about Prison Radio. How did it help you in prison?
It was immediately helpful. So at this point, I was working on the gardens. I'd just been sentenced. And whilst my sentence was very lenient and it was good news, I still had a few months left in prison. And my cellmate, she worked at NPR. And she said, oh, I should get you in. And I was angry that she hadn't suggested it sooner. And I was like, obviously get me in.
Yeah.
And then I started working there. And on my first day, I just saw like on the shared file, it's just called music, just this treasure trove. So my first day, I just plugged the headphones in and I was just listening. And I cried a little bit. There were some Elliott Smith songs on there. And just hearing those songs again, I started crying. But even just, I knew from the office environment from the get-go, everyone was really silly, had like a dorky sense of humour. And I thought, these are my people.
Yeah, I read that you said that you'd found your people, you'd found your tribe, basically.
Found my tribe, for sure. Yeah, I feel so comfortable around everyone that I work with. And it definitely is one of those situations where I'm like, well, they're my friends, you know, that not just my colleagues. But it was the access in the music, learning how to do the music software. And then when I sat in front of the mic and started talking, I just thought, why have I never thought of this before? Like, it just felt so natural. All the times I've sent 20-minute voice notes to my friends, all the times I've sat people down and said, this is why you need to listen to the Stranglers. And I could do that as a job. Like, I couldn't believe that was a real opportunity for me. So yeah, I just dove in and I just thought anything they offer, anything they want me to do, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to make myself available and just keep doing it, keep plugging away at it. And I'm going to be a nuisance and they're going to keep me around.
I think you have to be.
Anything creative, yeah. you've got to be a nuisance.
Yeah, I was. I was an absolute nuisance until they let me in the building.
Yeah, just keep showing up. Yeah.
You had some great comments from other inmates, and I saw that on the website, you know, about how they communicated with you and how that made them feel. But how do those comments make you feel?
Someone said to me about, would you want to work for a different radio station also doing a rock show? And I thought, why would I do that? I'm doing a rock show and I love the rock show. And part of what I love about it is, like, on my whiteboard next to me, if someone calls and say, oh, I've got parole in 2 weeks, I'll make sure to make a note of it so that when they have parole, I can say, all right, everyone send good vibes to, I don't know, Johnny or whatever, because it's important to me. I like having those same callers. I also like having people say, hey, this is the first time I've called in, because I think, oh, nice one. I bet you've been thinking about it for a little while and not been quite sure. So we had a show this week, actually, where we didn't get enough requests. So I had to just fill it with all songs that I like. And I was like a stern parent. I was like, you guys, I can't do this without you. You need to be calling in. I cannot do this without you. This is a two-way street. But it's true. Like, you can't. You're only as good as your listeners, right? You're only as good as how good your listeners think you are.
Because it's that connection then, isn't it?
Yeah, I definitely feel a connection to the listeners. And having been in prison myself, I know how vital it is. And just to have that relief where you can have a bit of a laugh. You don't laugh about much in prison. It's not funny. But when I started working at NPR and everyone was just being really silly in the office, I laughed. And I realised that's so important. So I try and bring that into the rock show because it's so important. You're not in a situation that lends itself to having a good time.
Every time we focus on prison radio on the Radio Academy podcast, it always comes through how vital it is, what a lifeline it is.
That's exactly the word. It's vital. It's absolutely crucial. And for, you know, for a lot of prisoners as well, that's their only sort of understanding of what's going on in the outside world is when they hear the news and things like that. When we hear new releases, new rock releases, and we put those in the show, that's something they otherwise would never know. They might never know that their favourite band has got a new frontman or whatever. That stuff's important to you, right? When you're following bands that you like around, that stuff matters.
Gonna be honest with you guys now, you know, since we're all friends. I've had a bit of a bummer of a week. There's like nothing bad happened. In fact, life on the face of it is really great. But I've just had the, you know, the sad gremlins. You know the ones. They're like invisible thieves of joy. And they suck all the life out of you for literally no reason. So I've been in my pit for a few days eating ice cream and listening to even more Elliott Smith than usual, which is already a lot. And I'm sitting here going through these requests and immediately I feel better. And I'm not even kidding.
The the other award that you won, which we touched on earlier, was the gold in the Creative or Technical Innovation Award category. This was for The Ballad of Scout and the Alcohol Tag, which was made in conjunction with BBC Radio 4 and Prison Radio Association. It really goes deep into your story, and your story is amazing, but it's heartbreaking and it's raw. And I found it an incredible listen, but a tough listen, because you are so honest in it.
I had to be.
What was it like telling your story in that way?
It wasn't difficult. It was an enormous relief to just get it out there. You know what? It was sort of like a mea culpa, just like, right, okay, yeah, I did this and it was awful, but let me just tell you why. It was almost like an exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
Got a lot of that stuff out. And when it came to working with Andrew and Ellen, those are the people I work closely with the sound design, I remember saying to Andrew, he was saying, oh, we've done the hearing the voices. It's kind of intense. I was like, good. I want the listener to feel really screwed up after listening to this, because I had to feel like that. I want them to feel even a portion of what I felt, and then they'll understand. And that's not me being sadistic to the listener. That's me sort of desperately saying, please understand what I went through. And if you feel a little bit messed up after listening to this, please appreciate what it's like to live through it.
And that's what that sound design did. It was so immersive that you did. I mean, when they were doing the voices that you were hearing. But hearing that back, when you listened to the finished product, did it trigger or open up anything?
It was a difficult listen. I think I've always been sort of out of touch with my feelings. I get a delayed reaction with my feelings. So a lot of people, when it went out, were calling me in tears, like people that are close to me, saying, oh my God, like I was there. I lived through it with you. But to hear it all in 28 minutes, to hear that whole 3 years in 28 minutes is really intense. And I remember sitting there on the phone thinking, yeah, I guess it is kind of intense. And it took me a while. And then I think it was like 3 months after it went out, I listened to it on my own with headphones and I did cry. I cried my eyes out. I needed to. It had to happen, and it felt good. You know, a good sort of healing.
Cathartic. Yeah.
Very cathartic. It needed to, because I barely cried in prison, barely cried since getting out. And that is because sometimes things have been so bad in the past, it's just been easier to go, do you know what? I've decided I'm not going to feel this anymore. I'm checking out, you know. So checking back in again. It's been a slow process. But yeah, when I heard it back, that was important.
The judge's citation said that they found the sound design was creative, particularly in how it enhanced the storytelling, they say. And then, this is the bit that got me, the bold mixture of humour and poetry felt fresh. And we'll talk about the poetry in a second. But there was one particular funny moment, Richard Madeley.
When Andrew Wilkie, the producer, when he sent me that, he just sent it me in a WhatsApp group and did not say, trigger warning, I've created the AI. So he just sent it me and I pressed play and I was like, oh God, it's happening again.
For anyone who's not heard the show, just explain the whole, it was the psychotic part of your psychotic episode, wasn't it? That you thought the TV was talking to you.
When I was 18, I had bad hallucinations that Richard Madeley was trying to contact me through the Richard and Judy show to warn me that the police were after me, because I thought I'd committed a series of murders. I'd just like to say to the listener, I have not. I've not committed a series or even one murder. And I thought it was Richard Madeley that was exposing it to the world and saying it to me. And so Andrew got AI. He used AI to recreate Richard Madeley's voice, saying those same things to me. That was quite intense hearing it. And then he said afterwards, oh, I should have put a trigger warning. And I was like, yeah, you should have. But then it was just really funny to hear it.
It was scary because it sounded just like Richard Madeley, didn't it?
For a second, I thought he'd got Madeley on board. Just like, did he know Richard Madeley? And just got, oh, come on, Richard. Can you just appear as a psychotic nightmare in this documentary?
If you woke up tomorrow and everything had been tilted 4 or 5 degrees to the left, you would know something was wrong, but you would not be able to say, you wouldn't be able to figure it out. You would just think, you know, am I being crazy or is everything just a bit different?
Scout.
And then I started to hear voices.
Please run away. There's danger.
Scout. Monster.
But I thought, that's normal, right? It's probably just all the drugs I'm doing.
Please, just go.
You look beautiful.
Mistake. Pack a bag. Tell nobody.
Scout.
Tell nobody.
You're going to change the world.
Tell nobody.
Scout.
I remember watching Richard and Judy. And Richard Madeley, I swear, looked me in the eyes and said, we're going to kill you.
Coming up on the next part of the show, there's a criminal at large named Scout Bolton who's wanted for several murders. Scout, we know what you've done. You can't stay hidden forever.
It was scary, but that was also funny. So I see what they mean about that mixture of humour. But it's a good job that you did find it funny.
Oh, God. So I've got quite a few friends who've got severe mental illness. We all sort of flock together and we do laugh about the things that we've thought in delusional states, because it is funny when you look back, because your brain's gone completely west and the things that it'll throw up when it's in that state, you look back, it's kind of hilarious. Like the time that I did buy, I saw this pair of shoes that I really liked. I thought, well, I like them so much, I don't ever want to run out. I better buy 20 pairs in different colours. But I was so manic, I forgot my shoe size. So I just had 20 pairs of shoes, size 5, that didn't fit me, too small. And looking back, that's so funny. It's so ridiculous. Hopping into taxis at 4 in the morning saying, drive me to Paris.
I mean, we're laughing, you know what I mean? Actually, like, yeah, it's scary.
At the time, it's scary because everything's going so fast. But when you look back, and it's not even one of those situations where people say, oh, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. No, just laugh. You can laugh if you feel comfortable laughing at the stuff you've been through, then that's, go for it. Have a chuckle about it.
We talked about the poetry, and that was a big part of the sound design and the part that you contributed, the poetry, and also the music as well that you wrote for it. When did you start writing the music and the poetry, and how do they help you?
I started writing poetry sort of in general back when I was about 20, 21, and I'm 36 now. That's how I've made my career. That's what I've always done, is I was a poet, and then I got into radio. And that's always helped me communicate that which I can't communicate in speech with poetry. Sometimes in the past, my poems have been a real cry for help, because I've not been able to say to people that I love, you know, I'm having these thoughts, but I can definitely put it in a poem. So they've become these sort of cryptic love letters over time. I said to my colleagues recently, when you're a creative, like we were saying, you've got to make yourself a nuisance. So when I was in prison still, I handed over the poems I'd been writing in prison just to sort of keep me busy. And I gave them to my colleague, Ellen. And I thought maybe she'll like them. Maybe she can hand them around. I don't know. I've got to give them to someone. I'm giving them to her. And then after reading those, she must have suggested to Andrew that I bring the poetry into the feature. As for the music, again, I'd written it in the bail hostel when I very first came out of jail, that song that was used. And then again, I sent it in the WhatsApp group to Ellen and Andrew, really hoping that they'd want to put it in the documentary. And then having to pretend like I hadn't thought of that when they suggested it. Like, oh yeah, what a great idea. I only sent it to you because I thought you might like it. Like, I didn't think for a second it would end up on the radio. I knew what I was doing there.
The both of those, knowing that they came from you, the poetry and the music, made that sound design so personal. When you listen to it, you think, oh my God, what you went through. And I read the article about your misdiagnosis in The Guardian. How are you now? How are you doing?
I'm okay. Like I said in the Guardian article, I do still have ups and downs. I've just come out of quite a dicey hypomania, which is sort of like a mild version of mania. I still get those. There's no pill that's ever going to take it away completely. But in that hypomania, I did behave a bit strangely, I guess. I spent a lot of money just taking myself off to hotels. So I stayed in 4 different hotels in 2 weeks, just locally, just fancy to change. Looking back, that was quite odd. And then I spent like a week in bed when the crash came. That sounds kind of, you know, chaotic and strange. But when I compare that to how it used to be, I'll take it. You know, I'll take a bit of odd behaviour for a couple of weeks, followed by a week in bed. It's nothing. And then I'll go months completely stable. And then I'll have a little blip. But it's not even enough to stop me from like doing my job, doing the school run. I can still get on with my life. I can still function. Whereas before, everything had broken down. And I do genuinely like to think, you know, whether you believe in God or the universe or what, that by the time I got arrested, it was some kind of higher power saying, we need a course correction. Things need to change. Mm-hmm. You cannot carry on like this. And things have changed now mentally. Yeah, the stability is nice. And I'm present with my children. I'm not always off in a different stratosphere. It's good. And, you know, the mild ups and downs, I'll take them, because they do still bring about that creative sensibility. And I'd really miss that if that went away. Sometimes feel like I've like hacked my illness. I still get to have the fun bits, but it's not going to ruin my life anymore. I almost feel lucky.
And what does the future hold then for your radio career?
Well, we're going to find out, really. I don't know. After sort of the success of the Arias, there's some stuff that me and my producer have been talking about potentially doing. Hush, hush, obviously, because it's still at pitching stage. I would like to continue doing music radio, but I really enjoyed writing that Guardian article, and I do sort of get on my high horse about the state of mental health in this country. I get on my high horse about a lot of things, and I think I'd like to sort of maybe take more of a journalism route in the future, but we'll see. It seems like it's out of my control, you know. I feel like whatever it is I'm meant to do in radio, it will just present itself in front of me. That's what's happened so far.
A big thank you to Scout for being such an amazing guest. The Ballad of Scout and the Alcohol Tag is still available to listen to on BBC Sounds. Tickets for the Radio Academy Festival are now on sale. The theme this year is World of Sound, and we return to the Royal College of Physicians in London on Wednesday, the 17th of September. For more details about early bird prices, to see which guest speakers are being announced, and to book tickets, head to radioacademy.org/festival. Our London Summer Social is on the 16th of July at The Lantern, hosted by Bauer Media. This event is free for Radio Academy members, and non-members can sign up for £4. Go to radioacademy.org/events to register. Next week, we'll bring you all the news, winner speeches, and backstage gossip from the International Women's Podcast Awards, which are taking place the evening before at the BBC Radio Theatre. I'll see you next week.